Hi, I'm Clay McLeod Chapman, author of Nothing Untoward, Tales from the Pumpkin Pie Show, and I am talking to Rabbi Saul Solomon on Days Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom, my friends. Hurrah for the fun. Are the corpses done? Hurrah for the pumpkin pie. Or, I should say, the Pumpkin Pie Show, which is an off-Broadway theatrical entertainment that has been around for quite a few years now and has been turned into a book called Nothing Untoward, Tales from the Pumpkin Pie Show. These are stories, many of them kind of creepy and funny and goofy, by Clay McLeod Chapman, one of the most goyish names I've ever heard, but we're going to talk to him anyway. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the creator of the Pumpkin Pie Show, the writer of Rest Area, and also of several short films, Clay McLeod Chapman. Shalom to you.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, you're most welcome. So, first of all, before we talk about the book, you sort of need to know about the show. How did the Pumpkin Pie Show come about?
Oh, you know, I was one of those disgruntled actors who was looking desperately for someone to cast, and so when nobody else would, I started writing my own shows, and nothing like a monologue to do a production of one, and I would just create these little performance pieces that would have me on cafes or black box theaters or, you know, my grandparents' basement, and I would just perform these pieces to whoever would listen to me.
Was this more like a Spalding Gray because you would read them without memorizing?
You know, just by the kind of sheer default of writing them and kind of speaking out loud as I would go, they would be kind of partially memorized by the time I reached the end. So they were kind of in my system, and by the time that I was actually up on my feet performing them, they would kind of take on a life of their own. So more Eric Bogosian or oh, Danny Hock, but yes, I'd say there's a bit of DNA of Spalding Gray in there as well.
Now, let me ask you, do you remember the very first story that you performed performatively in a pumpkin way?
I actually do. It's going back, I mean, I think probably 1996 or so. One of the first pieces was called A Baby Doll Licked in Mud. Oh my gosh, I haven't thought about this in a long time.
A baby doll
licked in mud.
Licked in mud. Oh boy.
Licked in mud, yeah. It was all about a road construction crew that stumbles upon a old abandoned farmhouse. There's a possessed or haunted baby doll kind of amongst the belongings and forgotten debris of a family that lived there. These construction workers kind of fight over who gets to keep the baby doll. So a baby doll licked in mud.
Okay. Now let me ask, were you influenced in your early years by The Twilight Zone? You mentioned H.P. Lovecraft when you were trying to sell the show.
Mm-hmm.
Who are the real influences there?
I mean, everybody from Flannery O'Connor to Faulkner to EC Comics, Tales from the Crypt to Twilight Zone for sure. I mean, it's kind of taking all of these disparate elements and blending them together from like Southern Gothic to comic book genre, horror mentality, and making something a little bit pastiche.
Pastiche? Oh, I like that. I even like pasticcio nuts. But, you know, that's terrible. We'll edit that. But when you did that first piece as performed, the one about the doll licked in the mud there, how long prior to that had you just been writing on paper short stories, or had you done your novel yet?
You know, these stories were, I mean, this is really how I cut my teeth. Like, I was writing plays from an early age, but short stories were kind of where my heart was at. Flannery O'Connor, a good man is hard to find. Like, that was immensely influential. So novels were kind of in the future at that point. If given a choice, I would probably still be writing short stories till the cows come home, but everybody seems to be more interested in things that are maybe a bit more expanded and 100, 200 pages. But for me, I love to live in that kind of 10-page zone.
And also, you do a lot of short films. You've got a couple coming out this year. The Dragon's Egg? What is that?
Oh, wow. the Dragon's Egg is actually going to be a feature. Ooh. We're kind of in pre-production right now, so that'll be a lengthy piece. We're talking probably a good old hour and a half, 2 hours of spooks and scares.
Oh, now when you say we, how are you involved? Are you just the screenwriter, or are you also involved in the production?
Just the writer, but if I have my way, I'll be the guy on set, kind of tugging on the director's pant leg and saying,
"Oh, he'll love that."
A little bit like that.
No, they'll throw you off set in 48 hours if you start doing that.
if I'm even able to make it to set, I'll see if I can last beyond 48.
I assume it's a somewhat low budget, but that could still be a few million dollars, right?
Oh, yeah. I will leave it up to cooler heads to prevail on what the ultimate budget will be, but I think we'll have a few zeros added to the end of it, for sure.
Ooh, any famous people in it?
At this point, no, but that's just because we are barely at the brink of beginning casting.
Ah.
So we are talking very, very early days here.
Do you need a rabbi?
We're looking for sure.
I can play a dragon. See, I can make fire come out of my tuchus and everything.
I believe it. Bring it on.
Oh, thank you. And what about this other movie that you've got coming out called Crawlers? Ooh.
Oh, man, you have pored over my IMDb page.
Yeah, pretty much.
That is a script that is even in earlier days. I'm actually kind of just doing a friendly rewrite pass on that script. It was written by a few other folks, and I've been brought on as a kind of advisor, contributor, rewriter type.
So make everybody a little jealous here. Who are some of the famous people who have been in movies that you have written or co-written? What? And people want to go, "Oh, you son of a bitch, you lucky bastard." So go.
Well, I wrote a film called The Boy, which was directed by Craig McNeil, and it starred Rainn Wilson, who I guess a lot of folks would remember from
The Office.
The American version of The Office. He played Dwight. He was in our film along with David Morse. So, and it was actually produced by Elijah Wood, Mr. Frodo, from Spectre Vision, his production company, Spectre Vision.
Now, how do you go from, I have a screenplay, I have an idea for a script, to getting it to Elijah Wood's production company, they're going, yes, and then suddenly casting, David Morse, who's a wonderful actor.
No, I mean, the way The Boy came about was actually we did a short film version of it first. Craig, the director of both the short and the feature, we had worked on the script together, did the festival circuit, made our way to Sundance, and at Sundance we started kind of, a few heads started turning our way, and one of those heads just so happened to be Elijah Wood, and he and his company kind of shepherded us under their wing. They said, "Hey, can this be a feature film?" And when anyone ever asks you that question, of course the immediate answer is yes, it can. And
then you
make it happen, by hook or by crook.
Is that happening more now? I mean, as you have credits, you get more credits. That's just the way the business works. So,
yes and no. I mean, there's always the kind of pounding of the pavement, for sure. And it's never, I don't think there's ever the kind of resting on the laurels and, now my phone is going to start ringing off the hook and everyone's going to ask me to write movies for them. It's easier and more validating to get into the room or get through the door, I guess you should say. But once you're in the room, through the door, you still have to impress upon these people, whoever these powers that be, that you can, execute and kind of do what it is that needs to get done.
Have you ever done the big Hollywood studio meeting sort of thing? it's all bullshit, but you still have to go through the thing?
I have jumped those hoops. There are plenty of hoops, and, just when you think you've jumped through your last hoop, there's still a lot more hoops, and I don't think the hoops will ever end. But those hoops lead to Hollywood, so that's not such a bad thing.
Okay, fair enough. Now, you're going to be ending the pumpkin pie show? Or is that going to continue?
I feel like it's been this thing that I've been doing for years now. This is our 20th year here in New York.
Mazel.
And I, you know, I, as long as there is an audience for it, I would love to keep doing it.
Oh, cool. I was under the misimpression that you're going to bring that to us. No, I'm thrilled. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. You never know. I mean, it's honestly like I feel as if, you know, I'm getting old and it's getting harder to do these pieces with the kind of vim and vigor that I have.
Wait, excuse me.
20.
How old are you?
84.
Okay, you are absolutely old. Yeah.
No, this is I'm turning 40 this year.
Wait a minute. You're turning 40? With all due respect, 40? Fuck you. 40? 40? Are you kidding me? 40 is old. Gewalt. Ay, 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 ay. I mean, really, at 40, you feel less vim?
Better. Hey, you know, I'm going to just say it, that, like, the pieces from the Pumpkin Pie Show, anyone who does them, you know, it's breaking a sweat for sure, and getting a little creaky, and, you know, I don't necessarily have the energy that I had when I first started writing these pieces, so the engine is slowing down ever so slowly.
And when you used to have, or maybe you still do occasionally, for pieces from a woman's point of view, you have Hannah Cheek. I know she's one of the actresses who joins in. Can you get other actors maybe to take up the slack?
I probably could, but, you know, I think at that point I want to think of the possibility of franchising. Let's see if somebody else would be willing to do these pieces for a change.
Or maybe, look at James Brown. James Brown, when he was in his 60s, he was still doing the concerts, but he had, like, five backup singers, and he had dancers, and he had midgets throwing confetti. You know, you just need a little extra. You know, you can still be up there. Before you're in your wheelchair at 47, Gewalt, gumming your oatmeal, old, old. We're talking with Clay McLeod Chapman, by the way, who is the author of the book Nothing Untoward, Tales from the Pumpkin Pie Show, which is available, by the way, from Applause Theater and Cinema Books, and also you can get them at all your usual book-buying places. What is it about the macabre that speaks to you?
I mean, I think it's just, it's something about where I'm coming from, where I've been, what I've read, what I've been exposed to, but I guess I want to say I'm a disciple of Poe. Like, I just love, you know, ever since I was a child, like, this was the kind of material that I responded to, you know, sitting around the campfire and kind of spinning those ghost stories during summer camp, being exposed to that cheesy horror film by my babysitter when I probably should have been watching Sesame Street. I mean, you name it, like, it's always been there, and I think I've just kind of gravitated more towards that kind of darker current. So when the choice of me kind of telling the stories that I want to tell, these are just the characters and the voices that I want to kind of embody, for better or for worse.
I've heard you say in interviews that a lot of things come from these little passages in newspapers, these little one-paragraph news stories that you'll find in a newspaper, and you'll hook on to something horrible and terrible in them, and that will expand into a story. But have you experienced any kind of real horror, you know, in your life, for reals?
Ooh, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I feel like for my parents' sake, I need to kind of go on record and saying, like, I had a great upbringing. You know, I was raised by my mother, a single parent family, you know, for most of my childhood, and she did a great job. I think if you want to kind of pull out the pop psychology of it, it was really, you know, in my mind, going to places that I haven't personally been, or hopefully never, ever, ever, ever will go to.
I mean, people see, like, a car accident and somebody flying through a windshield, or, you know, your first funeral, and you're a goy, so the casket's open. So, that sort of thing.
I mean, I can remember the first time I ever encountered death, for sure. Like,
who'd you kill?
Trip to, well, New York, little kid, coming up from Virginia. I'm a southern boy, so our first family trip to New York City, I was in Astor Place in, like, early, mid-80s or something like this, and we were walking walking down the street, I was with some family members, and there was this shot, this gunshot, loud popping sound, and everybody kind of scatters and turns, and somebody had actually shot a mailman, like a mail carrier had been shot and was in the street bleeding to death. And I mean, I had to be, you know, 5, 6, 7, something like this. And I just remember, you know, being so close in proximity to this man who was, you know, injured and wounded, and my mother kind of pulled me aside and kind of shielded me and, you know, wrapped her hand around my eyes and essentially said, you know, say a prayer for that man. And, you know, it was a very kind of distinct memory that I carry to this day. And gosh, you know, here I am living in New York now, and every time I walk through Astor Place, I just remember that one moment from my childhood.
Interesting. Now, is that a memory, just a memory, or is it trauma? Is there PTSD involved? Or is it just one of many, many memories? This was just a bad one.
I mean, I wouldn't even give it, cast judgment on it as a bad or good. I would just...
Well, no, it's bad.
Memory. For,
you saw someone shot to death. It's not good, you know.
It's not good. But I mean, like, it is, it, you know, the trauma for me was, you know, kind of bearing witness to this event and kind of seeing it kind of firsthand. There was no, you know, soundtrack or kind of patina of you know, it wasn't film or TV. It was right there in front of me, and just how kind of, you know, you see something that like that, and it's very jarring for sure.
Now, as a writer, you know, you have this niche that you are really into, of course, and we've been talking all about it. But do you sometimes feel pigeonholed in the sense that everybody expects you to have a dark twist? Everything's supposed to be macabre and sick and bad things happen, and sometimes you just want to write, you know, Hello, Dolly.
The rom-com?
Yeah, seriously.
I would feel I should be so lucky that anyone would want to pigeonhole me. Like, I don't feel as if I've reached a point in my career where anyone is paying attention to notice the difference between one piece and the other.
Hold on. No, let's remind everybody. You have a short story collection called Rest Area. You got the new Pumpkin Pie Show book. You've written a novel. You've written short films. You have a trilogy of young adult books called the Tribe Trilogy, and that's got some dark stuff in it. So, I mean, you are known on a certain level if you're not quote-unquote famous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it would be wonderful if there are more folks out there, you know, reading this stuff. I am one of these people who loves to do, you know, the only person who I have to kind of hold the bar is, I guess, myself. So, you know, if I'm not surprised, then, you know, then I'm kind of falling into bad habits. Mm. So, you know, whether it's a twist or a surprise ending, that's one thing. But I do think that for me, I have to kind of always subvert my own personal expectations. And that keeps it pretty fresh.
So is there a particular story or a longer piece that you've written that you would say is very un-Clay McLeod Chapman-like?
I don't know. Let me think. You mentioned the children's books, the YA books that I've written, and frankly, I feel like it should be illegal for me to write for younger kids. But you know, Disney, Mickey Mouse, God bless them. He said, like, hey, you wanna write some middle grade books for us? And I said, sure. And that was finding the line of like what is kind of permitted or expected, and you know, trying to find the way in which to kind of subvert the material in a way that felt safe and chaotic at the same time. And that was actually a lot of fun. The series is called The Tribe. The first book is Homeroom Headhunters. And the whole, I guess, the kind of gist of it is that it's kind of Fight Club for middle school kids. And that to me was, you know, writing that first book in particular was such a joy because I had no idea how I could get away with this stuff, but it was so much fun to try. And they published it.
Now, when you
Evan
came, when you finish that draft, not your final draft of the Headhunter one, the first book in that Tribe trilogy, and you sent it off to your editor, did Disney have any stuff coming back at you saying, oh, we love it, but this is a little too strong, or, you know, you can't quite go here at this grade level, this age level, or they just looked at it and did typical edits and said, make this clearer, make this funnier or something?
It was surprising. I have to give credit to my editor, who did a really solid job of letting me know that I was allowed to kind of push it. And it was kind of amazing, because for me, my default was, am I allowed to do this? Is this something that I can do? And he was like, yeah. Now, every step of the way, there's going to be tastemakers or I guess guardians of the gate who will kind of make decisions of who actually gets to read this stuff. So, you know, getting the book on the shelf was one thing. Getting it off the shelf and into the kind of target audience's hands is totally something else. So I have to get through librarians, teachers, parents, and then it becomes a very, very subjective kind of judgment call. Some parents love it, some parents don't. Some librarians won't put it on the shelf, others do.
You're not involved in it at that point, just the publishing company, no?
Yes. But, you know, we put forth the craziest, wildest book that we could, and it was fun. So, yeah.
Well, mazel. Certainly mazel on that. And are you going to do any more YA writing?
The answer, the short answer is yes, I am. The longer, more complicated answer is yes, but I can't talk about it just yet.
Is it for Disney or somewhere else? Is it
more weeks? There's some good news coming along the pike, and I'm very, very excited about it. And this summer is going to be spent working on, you know, putting together a new YA book. So I'm really, really excited about that.
Now, let me ask, you mentioned children and stuff and what they're reading. You have a kid. Is it a baby? Is it a toddler? Where's that?
Oh, my. I have two.
I have two of them.
Crazy. I have two kids now. I've got a 4-year-old and almost a 2-year-old. So it's pretty wild.
Do you keep daddy's books high up on the shelf?
They are way, way, way up on the top of the bookshelf, yes.
I mean, is there a point when your kid will realize, or they probably know already, that you're a writer, and they're going to want to read your stuff? Is it going to be 6 years old, you'll give them some stories,
It's going to be 18. There's just no way. Particularly the Pumpkin Pie Show pieces, the Nothing Untoward and Rest Area, I am ruining the day. I am not looking forward to having that conversation with my kids. But luckily, in the meantime, there's some things to kind of get in their way. I also write for Marvel Comics, Spider-Man and the Avengers. So there's enough stuff to keep them occupied in the meantime. I just have to basically just kind of distract them until they forget that I've written other ookier stuff.
And also what's kind of important there is you're keeping them fed. You know, with all these different projects that you have, no one of them sounds like it's really paying all the bills, but you put them all together, you know, you can raise two kids in New York City.
Yes, it's true. I am eking a very humble existence telling stories that I want to tell. So you will hear no complaints from me.
Now, do you have a Mrs. Chapman person?
There is. She goes by Mrs. Sen. She kept her name, and I get to keep mine. And we have some boys between us, and we're feeling pretty, pretty happy here in Brooklyn.
But let me ask you. I mean, at what point in the dating process did you show her the stuff that you write?
I have to come clean and admit that we met at one of these pumpkin pie shows. She came to see the show that we were doing at that point. I guess this was 2006. A friend of hers who just so happened to live in the apartment building that I lived in, who I had, I guess, harangued into coming to see, she dragged her friend along, and they kind of stuck around afterwards, and lo and behold, I was introduced to her and was instantly smitten, and that's how we met.
And you didn't disembowel her? Or do all these things that your characters do. That's the best thing. Mazel tov.
We saved that for the second date.
So let me ask you a question, though. A wife,
yes.
Two kids, living in New York, having to promote still, when you do the theater stuff, promote yourself, and do all the work that's involved in, well, you know, you got the Marvel comics here, and you got this there. What is your writing regimen? How do you make time to actually sit down and write stories and novels?
I mean, I'm a pretty big creature of habit, so like I have to at least spend the morning writing away, and if I don't, I just get pretty ornery. But I feel like you know, the great thing about being a writer is that, you know, if you got a laptop, you know, have work will travel. So I just take my writing with me wherever I go.
Do you ever get blocked?
Yes, occasionally, and you know, at that point, the thing to do is either put that particular piece down and maybe focus on something else, or throw a wrench in the works or a curveball and see if I can't rejigger or kind of, you know, disrupt my headspace and kind of think about whatever the piece is in a different way.
Cool. Let me ask you: you have also taught writing at the university. Do you have a particular method in the way that you teach short story writing?
I don't necessarily have a particular method, but I do feel like there's always a personal approach that I love and that I like to try to share with others, is just the idea of picking a perspective and telling that side of a story. So always kind of favoring first-person narrative over, say, third-person narrative. You know, just trying to facilitate this idea of, like, a point of view and, I don't know, kind of rooting a story within character.
And if you could boil down advice to a young wannabe writer, besides try first-person first, what would it be?
I mean, honestly, and it's going to sound canned, so forgive me, but it's, you know, the only two things I have is, you know, write religiously, write every day, write...
Well, I'm a rabbi, I always write religiously, in Hebrew sometimes.
There you go. And fail. I mean, honestly, like, just fail better, fail with upward mobility. Let everything be a kind of bridge to the next failure, and you know, let somebody else decide whether it's good or bad, but you know, throw it against the wall and see if it sticks, and if it doesn't, fine, at least you got it out of your system, and if it does, then you're even better off, because not only did you do it, but you did it well. So I think you gotta write. I mean, a writer's gotta write. Put the kind of internal critic aside and let the piece be what it needs to be, and if it is awful, it's awful. But I've written my fair share of awful things, and that's not going to change.
How do you know when something that you've written is awful? Because you really don't know when you're writing it a lot of the times. How do you go, you know, a week later, 2 weeks later, or is it the thing where you write something, look at it a week later, you'll think it's shit, and then you come back to it 6 months later, and it's like, oh, you know, that's not so bad.
I mean, I will admit that I tend to be in denial about what is awful of my own stuff. I might write something and be like, this is amazing, and lo and behold, it turns out it's not. And usually that's when I have a friendly read, either a good friend or enemy, who I want to subject to something in its kind of early stages. And I go to specific people in the hopes that they'll be frank and will kind of inform me that this should never, ever see the light of day.
Ooh. Because I think in other interviews and stuff, one thing that seems back in the day to have gotten under your skin is that you wrote a novel called Miss Corpus.
And, no, you're calling me out.
Well, and you said that the reviews were terrible. I haven't read the reviews, but you said that a lot of the reviews for it were terrible. But at the same time, when you have all those terrible reviews, there are other people, whether they're reviewing on Amazon or elsewhere, who really liked it. So how do you decide then what's good and bad and in the middle?
That's a tough call. I feel like what was really kind of beautiful about Miss Corpus was that it was, I really wanted to, I tried something probably bigger than my capacity as a writer to, achieve. I was a big fan of books like Spoon River Anthology and Winesburg, Ohio, which are these novels, quote unquote, or kind of larger macro stories that are kind of told from the perspectives of multiple narrators. So I wanted to write a novel that was just a big breakdown of the South. And I feel like the book I turned in maybe wasn't necessarily the book I had promised to write. So when my poor editor received this 500 page manuscript with say like 33 different narrators, she just kind of looked at me and said, "You don't expect us to publish this, right?"
Ouch.
And me being kind of naive and kind of green and wet behind the ears, I was like, "Yeah, of course I do." And Miss Corpus was a kind of education in how not to write a novel, as far as I'm concerned. The book I delivered versus the book that was published were different things per se. I don't know. It became a book outside of what I guess I had experienced writing it. I wrote that book in the rewriting of it, so that it by the time it made its way to the shelf, it felt like a different book than I had intended to. For better or for worse, and I feel really kind of conflicted about it. Like I wasn't necessarily ready to write a novel. But I gave it my best, and what has been ultimately rewarding about that experience is that the people who do respond to it respond to the book that they found, that they read, that they picked off the shelf. And like that to me is like one of the most kind of singularly bizarre experiences, where it's just like, I don't know the book that you read, sir, ma'am, but it means the world to me that you responded the way that you did. But I have to own both the negative and the positive on that. So it's,
well, that's
Kristen will say one thing.
No, that's a very mature attitude. Well, you know, you're old at 40, so yes, that's a pretty mature way of looking at it. Speaking of rewriting, when you do a short piece, the pieces in your book, Nothing Untoward, they're generally 5 to 6 type pages long. I mean, they are pretty short. Do you do a lot of rewriting, or mostly is it, you know, when it comes out, is it about 90% there, or at least 90% there until you perform it and then you revise it? How does that all work?
It's an interesting question. I feel like a lot of the revising happens in the kind of the writing. I sit down at the computer, I write the day away, maybe I'll get a paragraph, maybe I'll get a page, and then I'll step away, and then the next time I come back, I'll start at the very, very beginning again, and I'll comb through everything I had written, you know, previously, and kind of, you know, iron that stuff out and push through and write some more until you know, a week later, 5, 6, 10 pages later, there is a piece. So it's something that, you know, I always have to kind of return to the beginning to get a certain kind of flow or certain rhythm to that specific story. I feel like I'm just kind of internalizing the revision process as I'm writing, specifically with the short stories.
Do you have another full-length adult novel in you, do you think?
I do. Whether anyone wants to see it, read it, publish it, we'll see. All bets are off.
Is it in any sort of stage? I mean, have you done a draft? Have you worked on it, or is it just in your head?
I have written it. I've written a draft. I have given it to a friend to read. That friend is not talking to me at the moment. I have to see. I'll do a friendly check-in at some point soon. But
is he or she going to have you committed? Is it that sick? I'm kidding. I don't know.
Oh no, it's a. I actually feel like it's a. It could be very mature. But again, I have to chalk it up to there's a certain kind of drinking of the Kool-Aid that I need to do. Like I am in willful denial that like this is the greatest thing I've ever written, and then I need someone else to say this is the worst thing you've ever written, and until I've exorcised it from my system, like I have to believe it's gold. Until someone else just shoots holes through it.
Well, it has been a golden experience talking to Clay McLeod Chapman.
Thank you so much.
He's written the book Nothing Untoward, Tales from the Pumpkin Pie Show. By all means, go read it. Get it from Applause Theater and Cinema Books or your local bookseller. Also, his older books, you've got Rest Area. You can read Miss Corpus for yourself and make your own decisions. If you have young adults, they might try the Tribe trilogy and start looking for his films and seeing all of them. So very busy, very prolific, and certainly very fun to talk to Clay McLeod Chapman. Last question for you. What is your URL where people can find out your stuff and what you're up to? Yeah.
My website is claymcleodchapman.com. ClayMcLeodChapman.com, all one word. And then, I'm on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all those wonderful places. But, ClayMcLeodChapman.com.
And the last question for you. Since I know you're not Jewish, what were you raised as, if anything, religiously? Do you have any kind of religious practice in your life or home?
You know, there was a stepfather in there for a little bit who was Episcopal, and he took us to church for a few years, and then the stepfather wasn't there anymore, and then we stopped going to church shortly thereafter. So I feel like maybe that aids and abets to my pop psychology, but that was kind of the extent to it.
Okay, so you're kind of a instead of a secular humanist, you're a secular humanist in your writing. I don't even know what
the hell. I'll take it.
Well, we'll take you anytime. Clay McLeod Chapman, we want to thank you once again for being in the neighborhood with us, wishing you much more creativity in the years to come. Thank you and shalom.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.